Thank you, Pat. I am Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi.
I would be remiss if I didn't start out by thanking your committee for granting me the privilege of sharing this great conference with you. This is your 13th state conference, and it's a lucky number for me. My two initials and my name make 13. And I like it that way. And I like your 13th annual convention. And I'm most grateful to be a part of it. There are many, many in this audience whom I love more than I love myself. And I've had a most happy experience so far. You know, we are all here because of a miracle. This 13th annual convention is here because of a miracle. And a miracle, as you all know, is something that can't happen until it does. And for those amongst us who are brand new and who might think that they have lost a little time and might be commiserating the fact that they didn't find this thing 10 years before or 25 years before, I would remind you again that a miracle is something that can't happen until it does. You didn't lose any time, in my opinion. You didn't lose any time at all, because we have a little preparation to go through before we can get here. You see, we don't dress up and come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We gotta get ready. And how long it takes, and what it takes. Because we are peoples who have the ability to hear what we want to hear and see what we want to see and interpret both that which we hear and see the way we want to interpret it. And we can't hear till we can hear, and we can't see till we can see. I am quite sure that if the entire membership of Alcoholics Anonymous had called on me 30 days before I got here, and at that time, there were supposed to be 50,000 of us, if all of them had called on me at once, 30 days before I came crawling in, I would have agreed with them that I was worth saving. And I would have told them that I was real glad that they had found a way to take care of their problem. But I would have assured them that I'd take care of my own. Thank you very much. I'll never forget, many years ago, I was down at Little Rock, Arkansas, the Arkansas Convention. And our beloved then chairman of the Board of Trustees, Bernie Smith. Many of you know him and love him. If you know him, you love him. He's a great, great man, Bernie, a non-alcoholic. And he loved this society of ours so much that in my first trip to New York as a delegate from our area out there, Bernie got up out of a bed, in hospital bed in Scotland, and flew to New York to spend 3 days with us, and then had to fly back to the hospital. So, you know, he loves our society, too. And we were having dinner together. And Bernie said to me at dinner, "Chuck, if a board of unquestioned experts had examined you in your 20s and had told you what was going to happen to you if you continued to drink, would you have quit drinking?" And I said, "Why, no, Bernie." And he looked aghast. He says, "Mind you, I said a board of unquestioned experts." And I says, "By whose authority, Bernie?" You see, I always knew that alcohol could get you folks, but it couldn't get me. I was too smart. And so how long it takes, it takes, and what it takes, it takes. Now, until I had completely and totally run out of time and people and things and places and health and sanity and money and liquor, it wasn't my fault that I drank. It was your fault. If you stupid people had acted like I thought you ought to, I wouldn't have had to drink. It was everybody else's fault but mine. My boss caused me to get drunk lots of times. You see, it was very apparent to me that I had all the brains in the organization, and he had all the money and told me what to do. And the very thought of this caused me to get drunk. The injustice of it. And so I got drunk. My wife caused me to get drunk lots of times. And incidentally, if I hadn't been 18 years sober, you people would have caused me to get drunk today. Because every one of you have been asking me about my wife. I was telling them up in my room that some of these people down through the South that I've been working on for 10 years write out and tell her after Birmingham that they've gotten answers from her that they've been looking for all their lives. It's grounds for divorce. She caused me to get drunk lots of times. Of course, you see, she was the wife of the great Chamberlain. And what she did, she was supposed to do. And what she didn't do, I got gypped. She didn't love me enough, so I got drunk. And while she was a pretty good excuse, her mother was 10 times better. Yeah. one kid, and I was married to her. And she was living with us. And she had a grandstand seat watching me kill her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that well. Because, you see, if she hadn't been there, I wouldn't have had to kill her only daughter. And we had a mutual hating society that was beautiful to behold, believe me. Of course, I had to get drunk. Wouldn't anybody? But you know, it was marvelous what this program did for her after I got sober. I'm quite sure that if she'd come through the living room in the last year that she was sober, because she lived with us 5 years after I'd sobered up. And if she'd come through the house and found me slapping that only daughter of hers all over the living room, she would have said, "Why, Elsa, what have you done?" Program sure worked out well for her. But see, it wasn't my fault. It was your fault. It was everybody's fault. It was conditions and places and things and people. But it was never my fault. Until I had totally and completely run out of everything. And it was only then that I could see that if there be fault, it is mine. In all that time, nobody ever caught me and poured liquor down my gullet. Nobody ever did. And one of the things I never even saw in my worst days, and I saw many things, I can assure you. But one of the things I never saw a bottle jump off the shelf and come over and tip itself up. And pour itself down my gullet. I had to get the stuff, and it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. When you're only working a third of the time, and you got a family to raise, and you got liquor to buy, it ain't easy. But I did it. And so, the time has to come with all of us. When we see that if there be fault, it is mine. I'm the monkey that can't get along without that flit. And I think perhaps one of the greatest things that ever happened to any individual on this journey of life is that time when we can and do accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are. Because, you see, we have to go from where we are to where we're going. And if we don't know where we are, how are we going to go anyplace? You can't get there from here. It's a wonderful thing when we can say to ourselves, I accept me exactly as I am where I am. If there be fault, it is mine. Now, I couldn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous until after I'd run out of choice. As long as I had choice, my choice was not to come here. You see, I didn't even like the good people of the human race by this time. And the drunks I hated. Because I was a drunk, and I hated me, and I hated all of you. And the very idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was absolutely obnoxious to me. I couldn't come until I'd run out of choice. But don't be discouraged. If you happen to be an alcoholic, and if you keep messing with that flit, you will run out of choice. That time will come too. And it came for me in January of 1946. And I'm one of the fortunate ones who hasn't had to have a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill from my very first meeting. I had my 18th birthday without a pill or a drink in January of this year. By the grace of God, through the miracle of this great society of ours. I think that a banquet meeting is the happiest meeting at a convention. This is the happy meeting. And I'm so tickled that I got to talk tonight, because usually I have to close it. And that's the saddest meeting of the bunch. When you got to close up one of these things, because we don't like to see them get over. And I was thinking tonight, when your chairman so graciously read a portion of chapter 5, what a nice thing this was. What a nice gesture. Because, you see, that's what we do in our country all the time. We read one paragraph or so more than was read tonight. We read the ABCs, too, and stop at the end of the ABCs. A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would have sought. That's where we stop. We also read the traditions. And many of our groups out there, we also read the portion of chapter 3, about 2 pages of it. So we got a regular reading society out in our country. And we love it out there, because every time that chapter 5 is read, I am reminded that my very survival depends on the grace of God. And I love it. And oftentimes, mistakes are made in the reading of it. And lots of times the mistakes are almost better than the original. For instance, the first line. One evening in the meeting, the guy got up and read that. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly enjoyed our path. Now, isn't that terrific? You can't miss if you thoroughly enjoy this path. And I like that real good. And a long time ago, somebody got up and read the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our wives had become unmanageable. How true. And one I didn't like so well, a guy read one night, sought through prayer and medication.
Intelligentsia.
He's a writer and all that stuff. First time he read that, he got to the line right past the 12 steps. And he says, many of us exclaim, what an ordeal. And that's almost better, you know. And so it is that if we're not at an AA meeting, we don't hear things like that. And they're real good. I said I am an alcoholic. I'm neither proud of it, nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. I haven't any thought of when I crossed the line. I don't care, because I'm pretty much of the opinion that I was a cinch to become an alcoholic from the beginning. I had all the tendencies. But I had about 15 years of pretty good drinking, if there is such a thing. I mean, I had about 15 years where I wasn't in jail and didn't have the DTs and never had any alcoholic convulsions. Now, I think good drinking would be in comparison to that. That's all I know. Between good drinking and bad drinking. And after 15 years, something happened to my drinking. I had done my drinking according to code for the first 15 years. I had a code for drinking just like I had a code for everything else. And I stuck with it. But after 15 years, I wasn't drinking according to code. And I recognized that I had a problem. And I thought it was personal. I thought it was a weakness in me. And I thought the only way to get rid of it was to beat it at its own game. Total abstinence was not an answer, as far as I could see. Any weakling could quit drinking. But it took a pretty good man to meet this thing and beat it. So I started working on my problem 10 years before coming to the program. And I worked on it for 10 years. And the harder I worked, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder I worked. And I think that in the last 5 years of my drinking, at least 5 years, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. And it continued to get worse. Now, all during this last 10 years, people were talking to me about it. People were saying, "Me, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit." And this was not easy for me to take, because in most instances, it was obvious to me that they didn't have it, you know. They didn't have a body as strong as mine, and they most certainly weren't up to me mentally, in my opinion. And they say to me, "Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit." And I'd look at the pipsqueak and I'd say to myself, "Why in the hell can I drink? He does." And my answer to me was, "You can, and you got to prove it." And I kept right on trying to prove it for 10 years after I'd lost. And nobody ever told me the nature of my problem. Nobody. I didn't know what was wrong with me, and nobody ever told me. Now, in these last 10 years, I went to people that should have been able to tell me. I went to men of medicine. I went to men of the cloth. And I went to people that know more psychiatry than there is. And to a man, they talked to me about willpower, backbone, and standing up and being a man. And I didn't think I was weak in those departments. They didn't know the nature of my problem, and they couldn't help me. And I didn't know the nature of my problem, and I couldn't help myself. And so I had to run out of everything and come here before I found out what was the matter with me, why I couldn't drink like other people. Why can't I drink like other people? Because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism. Nobody ever told me this. I never heard it until I got to an AA meeting. And yet I remain to find that alcoholism is, medically speaking, the third worst killer in the United States today, topped only by heart and cancer. It's second only to one of our social diseases, a cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it's incurable, and that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. It's pretty rough. It's a matter of life and death. Now, the medical definition of the disease is that it's a disease of a twofold nature. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. It's both physical and mental. The reason I couldn't drink like that guy that was saying, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit, is because I'm different. I am different both physically and mentally, and this is an awful good thing to know. It's a real good thing to know. Now, the allergy of the body means simply this, that for some reason unknown to anybody, to medical science as well as to the rest of us, my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. I take one slug of liquor, I retain it, goes into the bloodstream of the brain, and it triggers a physical demand. That makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. Now, this is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor. It's only true of people like me. I'm different physically than the normal social drinker. We don't spend any time on what the physical difference is because, we said, nobody knows. They've been researching this thing for 40 years now. And medical science don't even know. So we don't spend any time on that. The things that are important for a guy like me are these. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. This is important. There's not a case in medical history where anybody like me ever returned to successful drinking. This in spite of the Harper article we read a while back. Did that turn you all over down here in Kentucky? We had quite a little fun out of it at home. And in the middle of the last summer, I ran onto a guy that knew the guy that wrote it. And it was real funny with me because he says this guy's already worn out 27 sponsors himself. There's not a case amongst us where anybody like me ever returned to successful drinking, and we're something like 500,000 strong. So the odds are 500,000 and nothing. That's not even good odds on the Kentucky Derby, let alone on our lives, you know. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And another thing that I must forever keep way up in the top of my consciousness is that the physical side of the disease of alcoholism gets worse with the passage of time, even when we're not drinking. Over any considerable period of time, says the book, we get worse, never better. Now, this is the thing thing that fools so very many of us. When we get sober and get healthy, get the wrinkles out of our tummies and a little money in our pockets, it's so easy for us to think that we've built up some good drinking time. You know, been away from that bottle for a few months or a few years, so I've built me up some good drinking time. This is impossible for the alcoholic because the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even though we're not drinking. This is the only disease I ever heard of that gets worse when you ain't doing it. Now, I am 18 years worse off, so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned, than I was when I got here. And I wasn't exactly in robust health when I came. Now, I know this, and I don't have to try it to prove it, because I have been close to and active in this program for 18 years. And when you're close to and active in, you don't have to try that, because your friends are forever trying it for you. I suspect that the greatest heartbreak any of us ever have to go through is to sit in a dark room with that man or that woman who's had from 10 to 20 years of total abstinence, who forgot. It's not good. But it makes it unnecessary for you to try it yourself. I know that I'm 18 years worse off so far as successfully drinking concerned than it was when I got here. And I don't have to try it. We had one boy out home. Came to the program the same month I did, 1946, January. He's very active. Many of you have heard his tapes. 15 years. One of the greatest speakers that ever came out of our part of the country. And after 15 straight years of total abstinence, 2 years ago last Christmas, he got mixed up with a little codeine, and a little alcohol, you know, and cough medicine. Had a little cough. Next thing you know, it was a little vodka, because it leaves you breathless, and it did. This man didn't last 2 months. We had to bury him after 15 straight years of total abstinence. So this is something we must remember. There's no such thing as an alcoholic building up any good drinking time. The physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even when we're not drinking. And lastly, there is no cure for the body. If we had all the money in town, it wouldn't be enough to send me someplace to get a cure for my body. There's no such cure. Now, if seeing this, we could decide to quit drinking and quit, we wouldn't have a problem in the world. It's easy for an alcoholic to see that one drink is too many and 1,000 aren't enough when it's explained to us. That is the first drink that we can't take. And this never occurred to me. It never occurred to me there was a first slug until you people told me about it. I was attempting for this entire last 10 years of my drinking to cut it off before the trouble started. I never thought it was the first drink. I thought it was the last gallon. Just cut it off before the trouble started. And I came here and you guys told me it was the first slug. Well, I could see it pretty easy. Although I never got drunk on one drink, particularly in that last 10 years, because I'd become periodic. By this time, for a very good reason. You see, I was going to beat this deal. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. And so I'd have to get well in order to get back in the ring. And I had a regular ritual in this, too. I'd knock it off when I couldn't even roll out of bed to go get another bottle. This is the only time I ever quit. I'd knock it off. For some reason or other, the family wouldn't bring me any by the end. They were very intolerant about it. And then I'd start getting well. And the only way I ever knew to get well was just to die until I started living. I never knew that there was such a thing as a drying out place until I came here, and then it was too late for me. And so I'd just shake my liver out until I could move again. And then I'd start doing things right, brother. I would eat well and sleep well and take my vitamins, exercise. The last few years I'd prepare on three fronts. I'd add a little religion and psychology to it. And when I was really in ship shape again, I'd start sampling my way back to bed. I never got drunk in a hurry. Until my last drunk. I'd do it very carefully. I'd take a drink. That's all. And 3 or 4 days go by, and I'd take 2. Nothing. They didn't bother me. A week would go by, and I'd go out and take a half dozen. Nothing. 2 weeks would go by, and I'd go to a party and have a normal evening drinking. Nothing. And then I would come up with a profound conclusion that I had elect. I was normal. And a week after that, I'd be drinking a pint a day. But that didn't bother. I could drink a quart a day and fool anybody, including my wife, if I could keep her from kissing me. And incidentally, she was not anxious to kiss me. But she had become a sniffer. She's considerably shorter than I am, you know, and there were about 4 steps coming up out of the backyard to get in the kitchen. And she'd stand on the top step, and as I came up, she'd come up. So I'd drink a pint a day for a week, and then I'd step it up 2 pints. And a couple of weeks of 2 pints, and then I'd quit eating, and you can't live on 2 pints if you don't eat. So I'd step it up to 3. And I'd drink 3 for a while, and then I'd get the flu. Call the office and say, Chuck's got the flu again. I was a fluidest man you ever knew. And I never had the flu in my life yet. And so then I'd go to bed and drink 4 pints. And I'd continue this until I couldn't even roll out of bed to look under it to see if I had any. And again, when that happened to me, I'd have to get sober again. But when you people told me it was the first drink I could see, it isn't that we get drunk when we first take a drink, or when we take the first drink. It's that we get drunk when we take the first drink before we quit taking a drink. The first drink starts the drunk, if we be alcoholic, and I could see it very plainly. And if seeing this, we could decide to quit drinking and quit, we wouldn't have a problem in the world. We just say, okay, it's not doing for me what it used to. It's gotten to the place where it hurts too bad to sober up. And I'll just cork up this bottle and put it on the shelf and leave it. But see, we can't do this. Why? Because the other half of the disease, the obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. When the body is dry, there is no physical demand for liquor. It's only after that first slug that the physical takes over. The first drink is mental. And the second drink and the 542nd drink are physical, but that first one is mental. And if you and I, being alcoholic, want to live without the bottle, we must be rid of the obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. This is the only hope we have. Because, you see, the obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. It's just as silly for an alcoholic to decide to quit drinking as it is for a tubercular to decide to quit coughing. If the tubercular is going to be rid of the cough, he must be rid of tuberculosis, its cause. And if I, being alcoholic, want to live without the bottle, I must be rid of the obsessions of the mind that cause me to drink. Now, how are we going to get rid of the obsessions of the mind? That's what our program is all about. We just recognize the physical part of the disease and turn to the mental, the obsessions of the mind. And thank God, we have a formula that's foolproof. All we have to do is to fulfill the conditions of the formula, and something happens, and we don't have to drink anymore. But there are only two classes of us that can fulfill the conditions of the formula. Just two classes of us. The first class are those who have run out of everything. I fall in this category myself. In crisis, it's not difficult to fulfill the conditions. When there's nothing left to do but this, we can do it. And the other class are those who come to see the nature of our problem. Either the alcoholic has to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, or he has to come to see that there's nothing ahead of him but permanent insanity or death, lest we will not fulfill the conditions for sobriety. Why? Because the first condition for sobriety is surrender. Surrender. One of the greatest lines in our book is, we cease to fight anything or anybody. One of the greatest lines in the book. Surrender. is the first condition. For sobriety, and an alcoholic can't do it. By the very nature of us, we can't surrender. I never surrendered once in 43 years of life because it was bred out of me. The weak man surrenders. The strong man wins his battle. And I could not surrender. And thank God I didn't have to. I didn't have to. That bottle finally surrendered me. It finally beat me into total and absolute nothingness. And you'd be surprised how easy it is to surrender when you ain't got nothing to give up. Would to God it was possible for one of us to tell another what it means to surrender. Would to God. I would rather be able to tell one audience what it means to surrender than to be president of the universe, all of it. I'd be willing to die on the way home, easy, if I could explain what it means to surrender. But it cannot be done. It cannot be done. The only thing we can say about it that surrenders victory, that perhaps there is no such thing as peace of mind and serenity of purpose as long as we have to satisfy the ego. What a day it is when we can abandon ourselves completely to this simple program. Let go absolutely, as the book says. This is victory. Don't be afraid of it. Now, what are the conditions for sobriety? The first one we find in chapter 3, where it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. That's what we were talking about a while ago. To accept ourselves as we are, to identify with each other and both halves of the disease of alcoholism, the physical and the mental. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. Number one. Number two, we find in the preamble where it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. Any length means number one. That's tops. That's the top man on the totem pole. The first thing in our lives. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Then you're ready to take certain steps. And then it says, here are the steps we took. Here are the steps we took. And it lists 12 steps. Now, it's very significant. This, here are the steps we took. It doesn't say, here are the steps we read. It doesn't say, here are the steps we heard read. It doesn't say, here are the steps we discussed in last night's discussion meeting. It doesn't say, here are the steps we interpreted. This just tickles the hell out of me. I'd like for one of you smart people to hop up and give me an interpretation of, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. How are you going to interpret that? 18 years ago, it had meant to be, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 18 years later, it means we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, period. Ha ha! It doesn't say here the steps we interpreted. And it doesn't say here the steps we conned God into taking for us. It says here the steps we took. Now, if you happen to be an alcoholic and you want to live without that bottle, took them. Just took them, that's all. And something will happen. And if you don't took them, nothing will happen. You can interpret all you want to. I've had to watch people die that could quote that book by heart. But they wouldn't took them. You know, it's that simple. And that's all that's wrong with the program. That's the only thing wrong with it. It's that simple. But we're not simple. We have the keen alcoholic mind. Here's another one that tickles me to death. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, we tell each other about the keen alcoholic mind. We don't hear anything about it out on the street. But we tell each other and we sort of like it. And with our keen alcoholic minds, we look at this simple program and we say, it can't be that simple. There must be a harder way than this, and I'm going to find it. Oh, me. We look at that page, you know, and we say, only half of this page is black, and the other half is white. Now, if these black lines mean so much, there must be some meaning in these white lines. And we start reading between the lines, you see. Or interpreting. Oh, my. If we could just get simple enough. Here are the steps we took. We're sober. Take them. Do the best you can one day at a time to apply these steps to your very own self. And something happens, and you don't have to drink anymore. There is a miracle here. But we don't bring it about. We do it about. When we do our part, God does His. Action is truly the magic word. And so we apply these principles to our very own selves, one day at a time, to the best of our ability. And the miracle takes place, and we wake up to the fact that it's taking place. We don't even know when. But it happens. And that's the wonder of AA. It is this simple. Why can't we get simple enough just to do it? Now, if it's this simple, how come we have so much trouble? How come? Well, I think one of the big stumbling blocks is that we read it a little bit different than it's written. How many of us read that first step? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable whilst drunk. How long can we struggle with this illusion? It don't say whilst drunk. But we read it that way, and we keep thinking about it that way. Continuing in the illusion that we're pretty cute operators when we're sober, you know? Then we read the second step and it says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now you go to a discussion meeting tomorrow night and discuss step two. And they'll say restore us to sanity. And the first guy you call on, we'll start talking about the insane things he did whilst drunk. And the second guy will tell you about the insane things he did whilst drunk. It don't say whilst drunk. Non-alcoholics do insane things whilst drunk. This doesn't allude to insanity whilst drunk. It alludes to insanity whilst sober. That allow a keen alcoholic mind like mine to analyze a drunk and look at a 25-year record that includes everything that can happen to an alcoholic and come up with a profound conclusion. This time it's going to be different. You see, this time. That's the insanity we got to get rid of. And that ain't whilst drunk, that's whilst sober. You know, this is an elusive step, this number two. This is a backhanded admission that we're nutty as a fruitcake. You see, there's no sense in restoring a sane person to sanity, is there? You ever think of that? An admission that we're nuts. And not whilst drunk. Just nuts, period. And the next one that we have most trouble with is the very next step. It says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. So we understood him. And we say, oh, don't understand him. I got to get me another book. I got to get me a tutor. And we get another book, and we read and nip and nip and read and read and nip, and then we nip and don't read. I got nothing against reading. Nothing. But I didn't get sober reading. I got drunker reading. I read for 35 years before I got here. Brother, I was a learned man. I wasn't known as a drunken deacon for 10 years for nothing, I'm telling you that. I got here and your guy says, here are the steps we took. And I wanted what you had and I started taking them. And that's all I've done for 18 years. I haven't had a drink. Or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. This does not have any illusion. No, that's not the word, illusion. It doesn't refer to understanding God at all. If understanding the infinite had been a condition for sobriety, I'd have died drunk 18 years ago. Because I was having considerable trouble tying my own shoes when I got here. It has no reference to understanding God. It has reference to the necessity of an individual experience. My God. Your God. I tried to find your God for 35 years and I couldn't find him. And I came here not even looking for mine, but looking for sobriety. And I did these things and my God found me, or we found each other or something. I don't know. I woke up to the fact that there it was. The necessity of individual experience. My God. If we can eliminate this kind of stuff and just do the do the things. One day at a time, to the best of our ability. We're all right. We're all right. Something will happen. And again, we don't bring it about. Now I'm going to stop and start over. I agree with the doctor. I have a physical allergy to alcohol, and I have the mental obsessions that cause me to drink. I am condemned by the obsessions of the mind to drink liquor, and I am condemned by the allergy of the body to die if I do. I know this. But there's a third factor. There is a third factor that probably predates and may be father to the obsessions of the mind and the allergy of the body. Because I am convinced with everything that's in me that alcoholism is a living problem, a total living problem. And you and I have to have a total living answer. And inasmuch as spiritual rest is the only answer that any alcoholic has ever had. In Alcoholics or in Alcoholics Anonymous or in any other approach to alcoholism, the only possibility for us to live without drinking is a basic spiritual rest. And inasmuch as this is true, then it seems to me kindergarten that the problem behind the problem is a basic spiritual unrest. I have 18 years in the program without a drink to look at, and 25 years of drinking, and the time before that. And I never had a drink until I was through school. I was an athlete. I was always in training. Never drank until I was out of school. And yet I look at my life, and from the very time I can remember, and I can remember many things at four, much better than I can remember those at 40. And from the beginning, I was a misfit in life. From the beginning, I was fighting life. From the beginning, I could not integrate myself into life, the life around me. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. Because every alcoholic wants so badly to be a part of, and he is forever apart from. And the reason I said a while ago, if there be fault, it is mine, is because I do not believe there's fault. I do not believe there's fault. I think we are the victims of a combination of wonderful characteristics. That we can't use properly. Now, if there's anything that this society has proven to me in 18 years, it's what we heard the lady talking about this afternoon. I am just as sure as that I stand here that we are God's kids, all of us, that we always were God's kids, even when we were drunk in the gutter, we were God's kids. And he has always known it, but you and I individually have to find it out. We have to find it out. And I am sure that as God's children, all peoples have these characteristics that I'm about to mention. To a degree, but only the alcoholic has them in this combination that we do. You know, every one of us that come here thinking that we're different. Everybody that comes to AA thinks he's different. Every one of us. And one of the great things about our society That is that if we stay, we find that we're a little different from the non-alcoholic world. But from each other, we're just alike. We're just alike. We're as alike as black-eyed peas. If you had us all in a bag and shook it up and pulled one out, that'd be it, brother. That's it. As alike as black-eyed peas. And we get these things in combination. All of us. Pretty much the same. We've heard a great deal about perfectionism. Every alcoholic I've ever known, regardless of race, creed, or color, regardless of intellectual background or none, every one of us, environment notwithstanding, to the contrary notwithstanding, every one of us perfectionist, idealist, with a terrific drive for excellence. Now, idealism is good. It's good, but it's also bad. For two reasons. Number one, it won't allow us to settle for what we see. This is the reason we couldn't integrate. It won't allow us to settle for what we see because we don't like it. And number two, it makes it necessary for us to make over everything around us. Everybody around us, we got to make over. Because they're not good enough for our pattern. Particularly our own people, our wives and our kids. I nearly ruined mine. Because I wanted my sons to be all Americans when they were four, five, 6 years old. I had them afraid to pick up a basketball or a baseball or a football. And when they didn't get out and get a job, I said, what the hell's the matter with you? You know, I was making my own way at 13. And you guys haven't even got a paper route. Get going. You know? We got to make them over. Good and bad, this perfectionism, this idealism. But we got it. And we were born, every one of us, with the interior awareness that life is a good and a big and a beautiful thing. Every one of us. And we look at it and it's not. I always knew, when I was a kid, I knew that life should be like the life I've got now. I was born with this, but it wasn't. Every place I looked, it was cheap and it was dirty and it was ugly. And that's bad. And we are a highly emotional, a sensitive lot. And it tickles me. Oh, how it tickles me. Because we don't show this kind of a picture to the public, you know. It's in here. But we don't show a very good picture to the public. How are you going to tell anybody about being sensitive when there you lay in the gutter and the pig got up and slowly walked away? Psychiatrists, you know, tell us that we are emotionally immature. This is the pronouncement of all psychiatry. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I think we're born with about 10 times the capacity for feeling that most people have. Because I've stood in front of an audience of several hundred people in Folsom Prison. It's not easy to get in Folsom. You can't even get in there for murder if it's the first time. You got to be an habitual to get in that joint. And they're supposed to be pretty bad. But I've stood in front of several hundred of them and watched them cry right along with me. And they weren't crying because they were emotionally immature. They were crying because of the great identity. They were just like I was. highly emotional. And we get this kind of a combination of characteristics. We can't integrate because we don't like it. We have this wonderful inside picture of how good life is, and it's not. And everything in life hurts us, and we start building the shell around ourselves, and we're forced into self-thinking, whether we like it or not. Because we're different, we don't fit. And self-thinking is insanity. And we end up hating ourselves so we can't even look in the glass to shave. We're caught in the combination of these characteristics. And when we find alcohol, it's not a problem. It's an answer. To every alcoholic, alcohol is an answer from the beginning, not a problem. And it's an answer we need very badly. Because it does two things for us. It lets us live in our own world, and it takes the rough edge off the world around us. And for 15 years, it was an answer for me. An answer that I needed very badly and could not find in any other place. But after 15 years, being the wrong answer, the answer turned on me and became the power. And it finally beat me to death. But I can stand here tonight and tell you that I bless the bottle. I bless it. I bless it. Because, you see, it finally conditioned me so that I could fulfill these conditions. And find the thing I've had to have since the day I was born, and the thing you've had to have since the day you were born. The right answer to life. A living answer. I'm an alcoholic. I can't live and drink, and I myself can't keep from drinking. And I'm 3,000 miles from home. Saturday. Why am I not drunk? What a setup. Why am I not drunk? Because I've got the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I got it. Now, what is the thing? It's just what I was talking about a minute ago. It's a basic spiritual rest. I'm not fighting me anymore, and I'm not fighting you anymore. And I'm not fighting life, and I'm not fighting God. I'm at peace with me, and I'm at peace with you, and with my God. And that's the only reason I'm not drinking. A drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill could do nothing for me but tear me down. Because I've got the thing. And the thing is a state of being. A state of being. That is so good that it makes a drink absolutely unnecessary. Now, why did I drink 20 years ago? Because of the same reason. A state of being. But a state of being that was so lousy, I had to get drunk to get rid of it. So the drinking was a state of being, and the answer is a state of being. One good and one bad. And how fortunate can we be, we drunks? And I guess one of the reasons that I've been so slap happy for 18 years is because I can take absolutely no credit for this. I couldn't come here as long as I had choice. If I could still live in left field, I'd still be out there. But I ran out of time. I couldn't live there anymore. And I came here, what for? To find God? Uh-uh. To get my wife back? No. She was gone, and I knew she should have been gone 10 years before. To get the love of my kids back? No, that was gone too. And I knew I wasn't even entitled to have it back. Peace of mind and serenity of purpose, never heard of it. I came here hoping against hope that I might find a way to live that didn't include drinking. I'd have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth, just as long as I didn't have to drink. And that was the only thing I hoped to find in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came. And people like you told me what was wrong with me. And told me how they got well. And I knew they were drunks. I knew. In those days, there was nobody in our country, in our part of the country, sober over 5 years. And most of them just a few months or a few days. And they looked put in like I did. They were marked up like I was, and they, you know, a couple of headlights here. But they weren't drunk. They weren't drunk. And I saw their eyes. And I saw and felt something that I would have given my last drop of blood to have. And they said, here are the steps we took. Do them, boy. Do them. Best your ability, one day at a time. And I do them. For sobriety. And I woke up to the fact 6 months later that I was sober and had been all the time. And that was the beginning of a series of awakenings that has continued for 17 and a half years. Waking to the fact that this has happened and that that's happened. And my life has been nothing but awakenings and discardings for 18 years now. Awakening to this great fact and discarding the things I've been conditioned to believe that were true, that are not true at all. And here then is what I think this thing is. And I'll say this and sit down. I don't believe it's some special dispensation from some far-off God. Something that might be granted or might be withheld at the whim of somebody. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I don't even believe it's something that's added. I think it's something uncovered. Something uncovered. You know, there was a monk many, many years ago, wasn't even a priest, he was just a monk. His name was Brother Lawrence. And he said, if you would find God, look deeper than yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. Look deeper than yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. And then there was a carpenter a couple of thousand years ago. He said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. He says, it's not in a mountain, not in a temple, not in Jerusalem. The kingdom of heaven is within you. And he says, it's not I, but the Father in me. He doeth the works. Now, how's a monkey like me going to look deep within himself? He's got some windows to wash. He's got some wreckage of the past to clear up. He's got to dig out. He's got to uncover. And how's he going to do it? By the application of these 12 steps to his very own life. By the surrender, by the recognition of the need for help. By the inventory. And by the amend steps. And we do these things, and we clear up the wreckage of the past, and we wash some windows, and pretty soon we can look deep within ourselves and find ourselves, and find each other, and our very own God. How fortunate are we? This new life of mine, and it's just as different. It's just as different as night and day. It's as though I walked straight north for 43 years and then made 180-degree turn and had walked south for 18. It's just that different. And it's something that I didn't bring about. Something I didn't bring about. It's just something that happened when I did these things. Now, many people say to me, Chuck, if there is a loving God, as you seem to think there is, how come he allowed you to spend 10 years in hell? And this is very simple to me. Very simple to me. I think God loves us enough to allow us to make our own mistakes, that we might the sooner run out of our own resources and have to come back home. And have to come back home to the living God that made us. It's not normal to walk alone. I walked alone for 43 years. This is not normal. It's cold outside. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life with our arms around each other, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love, helping each other over the hurdles of life. This is normal. It's not normal to be away from the Father's house. It's normal to become as little children, totally dependent, totally dependent on this great thing. Now, everything is good with me. I've been sober for 18 years. I haven't had to take a pill or a drink for 18 years. And that's good. Because physical sobriety and life are synonymous to me. I can't live and drink, and of myself I can't keep from drinking. And so this is the greatest gift any God could give me, that I can live today without drinking. And I'm most grateful for it. And this alone would be enough for me to thank God the rest of my life. But I got a new body out of this thing. New body. And my family was put back together. And many of you have met my wife. She was divorcing me 18 years ago. And we've had 17 and a half, the most wonderful years you can imagine. And those boys of ours. Pretty close. Pretty close. And my business life was put back together. I now own the company that they threw me out of 18 years ago. I never even dreamed of that when I was drunk. It was too much. But it happened. And all these things, and you, a family that's big as the world, people all over this world that love me, and people whom I love, and add to this a God of my very own. What a thing. And yet I'm the most dependent man you'll ever see. I am totally dependent. Absolutely dependent on you, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and on this program, and on my God. But it's not a dependence of fear. I haven't been afraid since I woke up the fact that I'm sober. I'm not afraid. Not afraid of me or you or God or the devil or things past, present, or future. So it isn't a dependence of fear, it's a dependence of certainty. A dependence of certainty. It's my business to walk in this way. It's my business to practice these principles in all of my affairs one day at a time. And it's my business to share. This is my business. And it's God's business to take care of me. And all I have to do is thank God and pass the ammunition. Thank God and pass the ammunition. How fortunate can a man be? Don't be afraid of this thing. Sure, there's sobriety here. And sobriety is precious. But there's the AA way of life, than which there is nothing finer under heaven. The only thing good about the disease of alcoholism is our answer. And it's worth every second that we had to spend in hell. Join us. Go down the road with us, because it's a good road. It's a good life. And how happy am I to share it with you. God bless you all. Thank you.